Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Welcome to the Latin American History Podcast, episode 97, America's Lost Chinese. Today we have a special interview episode with Hugo Wong about his book, America's Lost Chinese. Hugo's book tells a fascinating story, which spans three countries and two continents. It's also a story to which he has a personal connection. Thanks to this connection, as well as the work he has put in obtaining and analysing original documents, it shines a light on a relatively unknown episode in Latin American as well as US history. It spans the full spectrum of human experience. Involved in it are meetings with presidents and successful business ventures, but also revolution, discrimination, and massacre. So here's Hugo to tell us about Mexico's and America's lost Chinese. Well, thank you for coming on, Hugo. I really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Thanks for inviting me, Max.
So could you begin by telling us a bit about yourself and your connection to this story?
Sure. So I grew up between Mexico City and Paris, and three of my eight great-grandparents are Chinese. Later, my career brought me to China, where I lived for almost 15 years. 3 years ago, I decided to quit my job to embark on a personal research and writing journey. This resulted in a book titled America's Lost Chinese, which tells a story about the rise and fall of the Chinese community in Mexico, seen through the eyes of two of my maternal great-grandparents, Wong Fun Chuk and Leung Hing. Leung Hing is my mother's maternal grandfather, while Fun Chuk is the elder brother of her paternal one. My mother was born in Shanghai and is Chinese-looking, but never learned the language. Instead, she grew up in Mexico and is totally Mexican by culture. This book is, in a way, a search for my family's Chinese roots. I managed to uncover never seen before and more than 100 years old archive documents, including letters, photographs, articles, and even poems, which bring to life this story in a unique way. My book was first published in London last summer, with a second edition just out in Hong Kong this week. What compelled me to write this book is that I found the story to be quite extraordinary, as they attended and founded the first schools for Chinese in America and founded a Chinese colony like no other before in the New World, going through incredible victories and defeats. These two parents migrated to America in the 1870s when they were only 12 and 14 years old, respectively, fleeing poverty in China. Both were coming from Guangdong Province, their ancestral village, being only 40 miles apart and 100 miles away from the port of Hong Kong. When he landed in San Francisco in 1875, Fun Chuk already had parents in the US who had arrived in the 1850s, making me a fifth generation overseas Chinese.
And so what was the context in China at the time? What made your great-grandparents want to move to the USA?
So when my ancestors were born, Guangdong Province was nothing like today. It was rife with banditry, rebellions, lawlessness, and clan violence, each village being surrounded by walls and people living in constant fear of attacks. Relatively more prosperous, in past centuries, Guangdong Province had also received immigrants from other parts of China. The whole China suffered from overpopulation, but Guangdong was then one of the most overpopulated and overcrowded provinces in China, with its land only able to feed a third of its people. Guangdong province also suffered from droughts and tropical floods due to an inexistent or badly kept infrastructure. Government works were often left to decay or used privately, a common joke at the time being that no one in China is so imposed on and cheated as the emperor. Excess population and land scarcity meant poverty and famines. People were so destitute that they often had to sell their children into slavery or send them away as laborers, what had happened to Liang Qing. Poverty was exacerbated because more than 90% of peasants in Guangdong province were either tenant farmers or employed laborers, very few owning their land. Land scarcity increased rents, and most people live indebted all their lives. A common song talked at the time about the two swords waiting on the farmers' shoulders, high rents and high interest rates, and the three ways open to them, either escape, prison, or suicide. Debt is the main reason which forced Liang Qing's fathers to send his eldest son to America. The province of Guangdong has been historically the most open to the outside world. The nearby ports of Hong Kong had just been ceded to the British Empire to export its products, but now, ironically, also providing ships for the migrants to go abroad. The invention of the steam engine and the increasing supply of ships had also rendered the voyage to America cheaper. Migrants' journeys were facilitated by the fact that they could buy their boat tickets on credit, which many repaid over many years while working in slave-like conditions in America. Finally, although the gold rush had ended long ago and the transcontinental railroad had just been completed, California still offered many working opportunities for the Chinese, able to earn a multiple of their wages back home, which was the main reason why Fung Chuk and Liang Qing were now on their way to America.
And so what did they find when they reached the USA? I know that they moved on a second time to Mexico, so what was the reason for that?
Yeah, so Fung Chuk and Liang Qing had very different starts in California. Fung Chuk was from a less destitute family. He had an uncle when he arrived in San Francisco who put him in a missionary school, the first Chinese church in America, and the first Protestant church outside of China. The church was run by Reverend Loomis, who could speak some Chinese, and had earlier done missionary work in China. Fung Chuk also stayed at Reverend Loomis's home, where he worked as a butler. Some Americans believed then that the U.S. had a manifest destiny to do missionary work, not only in China, but also among the Chinese at home. This missionary experience was rare amongst Chinese. Less than 2% of Chinese migrants converted to Christianity. Not sure if that would help them in a U.S. society which predominantly rejected them. Tragically, the U.S. Congress would later use that lack of conversions as a further argument against the Chinese, passing anti-Chinese immigration laws. Also at the time, Chinese women mostly stayed at home and rarely traveled. Hence, only 7% of Chinese migrants were women, many of them prostitutes. As Chinese were not allowed to marry white women, that meant that there were very few Chinese families and even fewer Chinese children. By contrast, Liang Qing came from a poor family, bought his boat ticket on credit, and had to work to repay his loan and the one of his family. Liang Qing hence had to work in a laundry in San Francisco under difficult conditions, as everything was done manually. California was the land of pioneers, with very few women. Less than 1 in 6 people were women. Hence, there were 2,000 laundries in San Francisco alone, while there were none in China. When Fung Chuk and Qing arrived in the U.S., the economic crisis started to impact their lives. Unemployment had reached 30% in California, with the flow of migrants from Europe continuing unabated, while Chinese represented 1/4 of its workers. This created resentment, but also fear towards a migrant community known for its entirely distinct culture and its refusal to adopt Western ways. People worried then that California would become a huge Chinese colony. Chinese were blamed for lacking democratic ideals, without morality, as having no families in the U.S., with no desire to stay, and working for lower wages than the white people, in quasi-slavery and women in prostitution. This would lead to the passing by the U.S. Congress of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, banning Chinese immigration to the U.S., the first legislation of its kind, turning the USA into a nation of gatekeepers and the Chinese into its first illegal immigrants. This act and legislation would hinder Chinese-U.S. dialogue for decades. Fung Chuk witnessed one of the first anti-Chinese riots in San Francisco in 1877 and suffered from physical violence, the whole Chinese community living in constant fear, with killings, anti-Chinese riots, and mass expulsions happening all over the Pacific coast. Ordinary Americans decided to take immigration matters in their own hands, and this violence would continue until the end of the 19th century, when the U.S. government established a well-staffed and organized immigration department. The 30,000 Chinese in San Francisco, the de facto capital in the U.S., lived harsh lives, lacking any family and spiritual life, mainly living in their workplace and succumbing to the vices of opium, gambling, and prostitution. Saddened by the condition of his compatriots in San Francisco, Fung Chuk decided to try his luck in business, in the south across the Mexico-US border, rapidly crossing the border after US residence permit application was rejected. Leung Hing was hired at the same time to work for a US company to build the railroad in Mexico near the border with the US. Both would start their career in Mexico by building the new railroad, Funchuk as a labor organizer and Hing as a worker. Funchuk was finally able to use his language skills and Christian education to help his compatriots in their negotiations with their American employer.
And so what was life like when they reached Mexico? And were there any important events or interesting characters which stand out from their time there?
At the beginning, Mexico was more welcoming than the US, as the Chinese were needed for Mexican agriculture and rail construction. The Chinese had more freedom than in the US, being able to marry and become naturalized. However, Mexican society and government remained racist towards them. The Chinese were called motores de sangre, or blood engines, by the Mexicans, showing their low status in Mexican society. Also, only a small minority of Chinese became nationalized Mexicans, like Funchuk and Hing did. Yet, they were also considered better workers than the local Indians or mestizos, not as ideal as Europeans. The Mexican government wanted a whiter workforce. This was a typical case of state racism. This also created a lot of resentment from the Mexican lower classes. A common complaint and criticism of the Mexicans at the time was against the widespread belief that Mexicans were people who knew less and were less able than other nations of Earth. Another difference with California is that the Chinese enjoyed the full protection of the law and could buy land, meaning that a lot of them abandoned their manual jobs and opened their own businesses, many becoming merchants or independent farmers, not only laundry owners, cooks, or mining workers like in the US. The Chinese were not used to eat meat and instead started growing vegetables, changing the eating habits of the Mexicans, a phenomenon which also happened in other countries like in the US, Cuba, or Australia. In the north of Mexico, by 1930, the Chinese had monopolized the small grocery trade, something unimaginable then in any other Western country. Like Leung Hing, they were able to establish their businesses thanks to their native organizations or guilds, which gave them loans and arranged for their merchandise to be shipped from China or the US into Mexico. By tapping into those transnational organizations, the Chinese were able to obtain capital and a price advantage that their Mexican competitors could not achieve. Chinese tradesmen introduced unknown sales techniques in Mexico, like itinerant trade, providing credit to customers, carrying large inventories, and incentivizing customers with free products. The Mexican could not understand how the Chinese had become so successful merchants in such a small time and elevate themselves above the condition of worker, something they were not able to do themselves. The racism in Mexico took then an additional form than in the US. Where Chinese workers had only been vilified for stealing the employment of Americans. In Mexico, by contrast, the Chinese and other foreigners were also criticized for becoming successful and stealing business opportunities from the Mexicans. A Mexican industrialist wrote that foreign companies were behaving like the conquerors of a defeated country. The experience of Funchuk is even more spectacular, as he was able to tap into the capital of his clan to build a chain of hotels and establish extensive farms across the north of Mexico. Later, Funchuk partnered with Kong Youwei, a famous Chinese philosopher and politician in exile, to establish the Chinese colony of Torreón, with an international bank, a tramway company, a school for Chinese, a newspaper, department stores, and even a shipping venture. The Chinese also bought large parcels of land throughout that northern Mexican boomtown. In addition to the restaurants, laundries, and hotels, the Chinese controlled the food distribution of the entire city of Torreón. Never in history had a group of Chinese reached such level of economic influence over a Western population and territory. And like most American Chinese settlements at the time, with its employees' barracks or typical Chinese restaurants, laundries, and stores, this was a unique project, funded by large pools of international Chinese capital and aimed at building a large business to serve both local and Chinese customers. This was probably one of the first examples of such a Chinese colony in the global south outside of Asia. As they grew richer, many Chinese like Funchuk and Leung Hing also married Mexican wives, something that was not allowed to them in California either. But those marriages were shunned by Mexican society. It is estimated that a tenth to a fifth of the Chinese ended up marrying Mexican wives. Funchuk and Hing would each have 10 mixed children in Mexico, which, without doubts, facilitated their integration into Mexican society. The experience of my ancestors in Mexico was hence marked by greater acculturation into Mexican society, but because of their successes, by a strong resentment against what they had achieved as foreigners. The Chinese ambassador to Washington on a trip to Mexico, was impressed and he called Mexico a Chinese El Dorado. Before the revolution, Phuong Chuc became the first Chinese to be naturalized, and he got close with President Porfirio Diaz, who was the one who welcomed the Chinese in Mexico. The president even invited the school for Chinese that Phuong Chuc had founded to his castle of Chapultepec, where the Chinese were congratulated for their business success in Mexico. Phuong Chuc also partnered with the most progressive bureaucrats of the Mexican regime before and during the revolution, like Miguel Cárdenas, the governor of Coahuila State, with whom he went into business and who helped him found his school for Chinese. Later, he became friend with the revolutionary and Mexican president Venustiano Carranza, who is the father of the Mexican constitution. And he protected Phuong Chuc during the revolution against his arch enemy, the anti-Chinese Pancho Villa, who had ordered for all the Chinese to be killed.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
So it sounds like there was a good deal of success for the Chinese community in Mexico, yet in the end, most of them left. So what brought this exodus about?
So the crucial and changing moment for the Chinese was the Mexican Revolution, a popular and very violent uprising which lasted 10 long years, killing more than 1.5 million people, or 1 out of 10 Mexicans. The revolution was mainly driven by nationalism and socialism, but also anti-intellectualism, rejecting the technocrats of the previous regime. Each of those three principles put the Chinese migrants on the wrong side of history, as many had prospered in Mexico. The previous regime had been marked by extreme inequalities and injustice, all Mexican land being owned by less than 2% of the population, and wages being 1/15 of US ones, with 90% of Mexicans being considered poor and working in quasi-slavery. Many properties and infrastructure were owned by foreigners, who discriminated against local workers, the U.S. controlling a quarter of Mexican territory. Mexico accounted then for 50% of the total U.S. foreign investments abroad, and many Chinese worked for American companies. Phuong Chuc was a good example, having worked or partnered with Americans on railroads, mining, hotels, and farming projects. Although rejected by the U.S. immigration, thanks to his education and American friends, he would remain very close to the U.S. all his life. The revolutionary motto became for the motherland and for the race, rejecting all foreigners, but especially the Chinese, were so conspicuous. There were only 120,000 foreigners in Mexico, compared to the more than 30 million Europeans having migrated to the U.S. the previous century, making their success more obvious. Welcome turned suddenly into rejection and hatred against the Chinese community, who, because of their successes, became the scapegoats of the revolution. In 2 days, 203 Chinese, or half of the Chinese population of Torreón, including women and children, were massacred savagely by a mob of 4,000 people, made of released prisoners, soldiers, and common folks. Toron was characterized by corporations owned by absentee Chinese capitalists and employing Chinese people exclusively. Those owners did not have their mixed families living in Toron and were blamed for the rampant land speculation and for hoarding merchandise in times of crisis. All this had created resentment from the local populace. Funchuk, for example, didn't have his family in Torreón, but in Piedras Negras, near the U.S. border. During the looting of Torreón, other foreign communities did not suffer the same way, and the Chinese did not offer any resistance either, showing that the massacre had simply been an act of racist mass murder, as explained in independent investigation reports. These would be the largest massacre of Chinese in American history, destroying their colony of Torreón. More massacres followed during the decade of the revolution, totaling more than 1,000 victims, creating a reign of terror for the Chinese diaspora. After the revolution, those massacres were followed by anti-Chinese movements, the boycotts of Chinese businesses, the implementation of harsh racial laws, even worse than in the US, and a mass expulsion of the Chinese from three northern provinces. Those laws prevented mixed marriages, segregated the Chinese in certain neighborhoods, and preventing them from carrying their businesses any longer, being a way for Mexicans to steal their possessions. The new Mexican president, Plutarco Elias Calles, admired European populists and fascist dictators and would copy their style and policies. If fascism was growing in Europe and Asia, it had reached Latin America too. Interestingly, similar anti-Chinese laws would be replicated in Peru a few years later. It is worth noting that with his businesses, Funchuk would personally clash with two Mexican presidents, Francisco Madero, who was competing with his business in Torreón, and later with Plutarco Elias Calles, who dispossessed him of his farm and implemented anti-Chinese laws and the mass expulsion of Chinese out of the country. Of the 60,000 Chinese who had entered Mexico at the start of the century, less than 5,000 were left by 1940. It is worth pointing out that in many countries where mass migration of Chinese happened, those were often followed by mass killings, often motivated by economic resentment, like in the Philippines in the 17th and 18th century, in Peru and the US in the 19th, and in Mexico and Southeast Asia in the 20th.
So what do we know about the lives of those who were forced to leave Mexico? Do we know where they ended up?
So the Chinese who left Mexico consisted of two categories. First, the rich merchants from the northern states whose properties had been stolen and who had been expulsed by the government to China by the United States. And two, by the poor workers who left as they could not be employed by their fellow Chinese anymore due to the anti-Chinese laws or simply because they did not find the Mexican wages compelling due to the economic crisis of 1929. Not much is known about the poor workers forced to leave. A minority of them immigrated illegally to the US, while others went to other countries in the diaspora, like in Southeast Asia or South America. Some also returned to China. Contrary to the situation in the US 40 years earlier, the Chinese in Mexico did not have a San Francisco Chinatown where they could hide, and the low wages made the immigration to other countries more compelling. The Chinese who stayed behind in Mexico were amongst the more affluent ones, who had managed to create ties with the country and who were not in the north, where the discrimination had been particularly harsh. Those included Liang Hing and Funchuk. More is known of the 4,000 or so merchants who left the northern Mexican states. They were repatriated into China and often expulsed with their Mexican wives and mixed families. Back in China, the Mexican wives had a tough time adjusting to their new lives in Guangdong province, where women had a low status and sometimes found out that their husbands were already married in China. Besides, by marrying Chinese, they had also lost their Mexican citizenship and were now stateless. After the war and during the Chinese Revolution, those families would be further discriminated, many finding refuge in the Iberian colony of Macau. Being shunned by both Mexico and China, they would only be accepted by the missionaries in Macau. In Canton, they brought their Mexican culture with them, and some of the traditions later spread to the Chinese, like the pineapple bun, the cousin of the Mexican sweet bread concha, showing that Mexicans had also a small impact on the Chinese cuisine in Hong Kong and Macau. In 1960, 30 years after their expulsion, those families would finally be allowed to come back to Mexico by President Lopez Mateo. A Chinese-Mexican activist tells the story of a returnee, now in his 70s, who never left his home without his immigration papers, in fear of being deported all over again.
So you mentioned the legacy of Mexican food in Hong Kong there, but are there any other noticeable legacies of this story, either in Mexico, the USA, or back in China?
So there is a voluntary amnesia of those events in Mexico, like, for example, the Torreon massacre, including within the Chinese community, people preferring to forget those years of exclusion and racism. In my own family, for example, not many people actually are knowledgeable about what happened in Torreon. Besides, Chinese migrants remain optimists. That was the only way to survive, thinking that those massacres would not happen again, and hence making their memory superfluous. One obvious reason for that is the almost complete assimilation of the descendants into Mexican society, and the fact that there were very few survivors or witnesses left in any case. Most of the descendants today likely count both victims and perpetrators of past violence, a tribute to the Mexican melting pot. Facing this exclusion, the few remaining Chinese decided to hide their origins and blend in. Liang Qing, for example, forbid his younger children to learn Chinese, as China was undergoing its own revolution and was affected by political upheavals. He believed that Mexico was their only future. He had also Mexicanized earlier his name from Liang Qing to Jorge León. Various members of my family had also fake birth certificates showing they were born in Mexico instead of China. Also, unlike the US, the remaining Chinese community lacked the critical mass to allow for its breed to reproduce itself, instead being condemned to complete assimilation. Mexico lacked the large Chinatowns in the US. Besides violence and racism, there are other reasons behind the Chinese community almost complete extinction or assimilation, including the harsh economic crisis in America and the relatively better living conditions in China than in the previous century. An important point to make is that the remaining Chinese who stayed did everything they could to become Mexicans, by their mixed marriages, for example, and by a complete acculturation. By contrast, in the US, until the Second World War, many Chinese continued to live among themselves in their Chinatowns, teaching their children Chinese, knowing that they would later be forced to work in Chinatown or have better opportunities going back to China. Today, the descendants of those early migrants are only half, a quarter, or an eighth Chinese, having lost much links to China, but yet remaining proud of their heritage. The closing of China for almost four decades did not help either those Chinese to keep a link with their country of origin. In recent history, some Mexican civil servants have also tried to erase some facts about Torreon in history books, and attempts to memorialize Chinese history were vandalized in Torreon. The Mexican census today still does not recognize nor tracks the many different minorities in the country. This may be due to the fact that Mexico sees itself as a mixed race and tolerant country, making those distinctions unnecessary, which is in many ways true today. The country believes, hopefully rightly, that it has put its problems of racism behind, as more than 70% of its population is mestizo. Mexico may have a problem conceptualizing that a victim of racism itself, in particular vis-a-vis its northern neighbor, it can also itself be a perpetrator of racism, like against the Chinese, for example. This is exemplified in Mexico's most iconic painting or mural by Diego Rivera, Dream of a Sunday Afternoon in Alameda Central, painted in the 1950s, which depicts a Chinese policeman with evil traits expelling a Mexican Indian from the park. Like in the US 50 years earlier, the Chinese are again depicted as being on the side of the exploiters and against the common people. Nonetheless, it is also remarkable that in 2021, 110 years after the Torreon massacre, the Mexican president, Manuel López Obrador, asked for forgiveness from the Chinese in an official ceremony with the Chinese ambassador present. This story should still be relevant to Mexico, the US, and China, at a time when China and the US are competing for hearts and minds in the global South. China today has already become the main trading partner of most countries in South America, and is now Mexico's second trading partner behind the US. As before, the Chinese are fast becoming the second largest migrant group in Mexico after the US, closely trailing the Colombians. Chinese are building factories all over Mexico, in part to circumvent US anti-trade laws. Also, Mexico has become the second importer of Chinese cars in the world after Russia. Finally, Chinese illegal migration to the US via Mexico has also jumped last year. The story of the Chinese in Mexico, or more generally, of transnational trade and investment, can offer many lessons to all three countries, in particular on the pitfalls of advancing purely economic goals for a country at the expense of social justice at home.
Well, that was fascinating. I knew almost nothing of what you've talked about today, so thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with us.
No, thanks again, Max, for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Have you found this story as interesting as I did and want to read the book? America's Lost Chinese is available to buy now, and a quick internet search will bring up several places where you can purchase it.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsargent.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica, and that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @historylatinam, and if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsargentphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.